Okay, our next speaker, Matt Baker, we're going to talk about managing soil microbial communities for pathogen control. Okay, thanks Dan and everyone for being here. So I'm going to try to get through three kind of mini stories here, and with just 15 minutes, I'm going to go really light on methods. So let's talk about those later if you have questions or are interested. So the first thing is going to be about pathogen suppression directly, illustrated here by the inhibition assay on a petri dish where these small spots are isolates of streptomyces that have been grown, and then their production of antibiotics is visualized with an indicator strain that's then grown over the whole surface of the plate, and you see these zones of inhibition there indicating antibiotic production. So we'll talk about those phenotypes. And then the second short story will be about microbial community assembly with an analogy here of jelly beans representing microbial cells. And then thirdly, about cover crops. So just launch into the first one. So one phenotype that we desire to have among soil microbes is the ability to suppress plant pathogens. That's illustrated here with the picture of the potatoes. So on the right, these potatoes, in the presence of a pathogen, have developed these corky lesions that are the symptoms of potato scab. But if we introduce a beneficial antagonist of that pathogen, then we get potatoes like those on the left, where the disease is controlled because the pathogen has been prevented from establishing. The plate just shows what streptomyces look like in culture, and then you've seen the inhibition assay. So we know already, you know, there's this beneficial phenotype among some soil bacteria. We even know, you know, which taxonomic category of bacteria possess this phenotype. Now, how could we go about encouraging that in our agricultural systems? Well, I've been interested for a long time in how plants shape soil microbial communities, and so wanted to look at how our choice of plant cover, which is primarily what we decide in crop production, is what kind of plants are going to grow in a place. How does that choice of plant cover influence these soil bacteria? So I went to an experiment that had a really dramatic change in plant cover, which was a move from a virgin selecting for pathogen suppressive microbes. So that took some rethink in terms of why that might be the case. But I think there's a helpful insight in that, and it comes from asking the question, not just, you know, what are the desirable phenotypes, who possesses those phenotypes, but then to ask the deeper question of why do they have those phenotypes? Why do those phenotypes persist in the community? Thank you. So here's the first experiment I described. I'm going to have to just skip through this for time, maybe to here. And the way we ended up conceiving of it is these pathogen inhibitory phenotypes, which in this group of bacteria are related to antibiotic production, result from competitive interactions among saprotrophic organisms. And the pathogen is not actually directly relevant to that. Pathogen control occurs in this system, I think, largely as collateral damage in this chemical warfare between saprotrophs. And the tie to the agricultural management and the plant cover is that we set the stage for those competitive interactions through resource provision. So if we constrain resources in terms of chemical diversity by growing monoculture, just a single kind of plant repeatedly, we can make an analogy here to a plate of cookies in which the plate is full of all one kind of cookie. And if each of us are trying to eat those cookies and every time the plate gets filled they're always the same kind, then we're all trying to get really good at eating the same thing, and pretty soon we're going to come to blows over who gets that chocolate chip cookie. And so that drives selection for these competitive phenotypes that result in pathogen suppression. In contrast, if we have really diverse plant cover, we can think of it as a plate of cookies in which there's a big variety there. And every time the plate gets refilled, there's all different kinds. And so I can say, you know, I know you really want the peanuts. I'm not going to fight you for the peanuts. Instead, I'm going to get really good at eating the cinnamon swirl cookies there. And so we provide an alternative coevolutionary trajectory that removes the strong selection for antibiotic production by allowing for niche differentiation as an alternative. Okay, into the second story here. So when we talk about managing microbial communities, kind of the primary assumption there is that we can take communities that initially differ from each other in some way, and through our management we can homogenize them or drive them to some consistent outcome. And that seemed to me like an important thing to test directly. So here's, I guess I've got a thing for junk food analogies, but so these piles of jelly beans representing different microbial communities through some management, can we take those two different starting points on the left and drive them to some common end point? And thinking about how to test that, it seemed to me that maybe the rhizosphere development was a good model system for that. So as a plant grows and sends its roots out into the soil, it encounters different bulk soil communities, and through a variety of processes, plants reshape those communities into something very different that inhabits the rhizosphere. And so I designed an experiment to test whether a plant could do that consistently across different starting points. Just a small piece of the data from that study. So here we have two different soils that we're contrasting. One is a sandy loam and one is a clay. And you can see the different colored bars representing different bacterial and archaeal phyla. So we have slightly different communities across these two soils. But we also have confounded with that a lot of differences in soil properties. And so I thought we should find a way to, within a given soil, vary the microbial communities in some fashion, and then try to impose management, in this case, rhizosphere development, and see whether we can get some consistent outcome from those diverse starting points. So the approach I took was to apply resource amendments repeatedly to these soils. So add glucose repeatedly over time or add starch. And, a labile amendment that would hopefully be respired and kind of removed from the system but would change the microbial community. So you can see the impacts of those resource amendments here, and then introduce a plant, allow for rhizosphere development, and then see if all of the rhizospheres have some similar structure. So if we look here first at the bottom row, we see that the plant in soil 2 has been fairly effective in taking that variation among communities with a history of different resource amendments and bringing it to some fairly consistent outcome. So the three bars at the lower right are all looking fairly similar to each other, or more similar than the three bars in the middle of the bottom. But there's a pretty different story in the top row in the sandy soil, where you can see that there are sort of two different outcomes here in the rhizosphere. These two treatments don't look very much like this one. So something went on here that made the plant unable to effectively or consistently manage those communities in the rhizosphere. And I think what happened here is that the selection due to the sugar addition was so extreme. You can see that this community is really almost entirely dominated by the firmicutes. That certain taxa were driven, almost to extirpation from that soil. And then, interestingly, what happens is not that in the absence of light blue, if we've eliminated it here, all the other taxa sort of incrementally adjust their abundances to accommodate blue being missing. Instead, it's in the absence of, light blue and yellow, say, the whole community develops into some fundamentally different state. So that's kind of a cautionary tale for this idea that we could consistently manage communities. It would suggest that there's some limit on the initial variation in community structure that we can accommodate and still get some kind of consistent outcome. Okay, and then I'm going to jump into the third story, which is about cover crops. It's a practice that's getting a lot of attention, and some of the following speakers are going to address it as well, so I won't say too much about what cover cropping is, except here's an example from one of Tom's field experiments that shows what it can look like in a no-till silage production system. And here's what corn coming up through a dead cereal rye cover crop can look like. And my interest in this system is about shared pathogens between the cover crops and the grain crop. So you can see that the corn and the rye here are growing in very intimate association. In a no-till system, they're probably even sending roots through the same soil pores, and so there's probably a lot of root-to-root contact and so on. And so what's going on with microbial communities in the roots of those cover crops, and with a particular focus on pathogens? just starting with one pathogen here, this is Fusarium graminearum, and comparing in the blue bars corn radicals grown in a fallow control, and the red bars corn radicals grown following a rye cover crop. And then layered into the experiment are two different kind of termination timings. So either we sprayed the cover crop and planted the corn early, or we waited two additional weeks before we killed the cover crop and planted the corn. And in both cases, you can see there's a significant increase in the load of this pathogen in corn radicals assessed by quantitative PCR when the corn is grown in that residue of a cover crop. So the values here have been log transformed, so this y-axis range here represents a tenfold increase in pathogen density in the roots of the cover crop. Now I'll just reveal additional pathogens for which collected the same data, another Fusarium species on the top and then two Pythium species on the bottom. And you can see that in three out of the four cases, the corn seedlings have higher pathogen loads in their roots when they're following the rye cover crop. So I have the expectation that the pathogens in those recently dead rye plants will at some point be displaced by more strongly competitive saprotrophs. But the timing of that and the, you know, dynamics through which that occurs are uncertain. So I went into the roots of those rye cover crops over time to track what's going on inside those roots and how the pathogen load is changing over time. So this data here is looking in the corn, but now I'm switching to look in the roots of the cereal rye. And so here's an example of the one of the Pythium species, and you can see it kind of declining over time in the roots of that rye, which is what I expect, that it would be displaced. And for the other, the same four pathogens, some of them not changing very much, such as the Fusarium graminearum up here, others of them behaving sort of unpredictably, or again, not changing very much. But what's interesting is, okay, so I just took away the bottom two there, but kept the top. And now I'm going to just plot the same data again, but with this, with the corresponding data from another field site. It's just a couple of kilometers away. And you can see that the pathogen is behaving very differently here. So the same variety of cereal rye, you know, managed pretty similarly in a field just a couple of kilometers away. Here the Fusarium didn't change very much in density in the roots of those rye, but at another field site, it increased over 100-fold in density in the first month after the cover crop was terminated. So that's a real challenge for management, because one field is not behaving the same way as another one. So how can we hope to, you know, control these dynamics in some predictable way? Looking with some amplicon sequencing for fungi in these roots of cereal rye, we do see the community shifting predictably with time, or at least consistently. And we see some increase in fungal diversity, which would make sense as saprotrophs gain more ready access to the roots as the host dies and as decomposition proceeds. And we detect a number of potential corn pathogens in the roots of these plants, of the cover crop plants. And one last point is, interestingly, sequencing OMI seeds rather than the fungi reveals that they are structured by some different forces. So here we have a little bit of separation along the second axis here by DPS's days post-spraying. So as those roots are dead for increasing amounts of time, we get a little bit of separation along the second axis. But most of the separation is along a different axis, which corresponds to the spatial arrangement of the samples. So for the OMI seeds, it matters more where precisely in the field the sample is drawn than it does how long these plants have been dead. Okay, so I better go quickly here, but, you know, we're always managing soil microbial communities, even if that's not our goal. And for cover crops, that's just as true as anything. And so we should be thinking about ways to manage cover crops that will limit the potential for shared pathogens, potentially, you know, accelerate this process of pathogen displacement by sapotrophs. And something that I'd love to look at, you know, if I had the luxury of a stable long-term position, would be what are the impacts of long-term improvements and changes in soil quality associated with cover cropping and no-till management, and how does that influence pathogen dynamics. So I better skip the summary because I'm out of time, but thanks.